Hello and welcome to a special edition of Background Briefing, live from the Los Angeles Times Book Festival at UCLA. I'm Ian Masters, and today we have a number of guests who are here at the LA Times Book Festival. We'll be joined in a moment by Kevin Phillips, an author and commentator who focuses on politics, economics, and history. Formerly a Republican Party strategist, he held a senior position in the 1968 Nixon campaign and was largely credited with the Republican Southern strategy, which has held that party in power for the last 4 decades. He's a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times, National Public Radio, and an analyst for PBS's Now with Bill Moyers. The author of 12 books, which include Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich, American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush, and American Theocracy, The Perils and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Kevin Phillips' new book is Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. We'll talk about the possibility of a food crisis, or a food shock, if you will, with Raj Patel, scholar, journalist, activist, and author. He has a new book out, Stuffed and Starved. We'll also be joined by James Howard Kunstler, who's an author and social critic, a novelist. He's written a book about a dystopian view of the United States. His previous book, The Long Emergency, argues that declining oil production is likely to result in the end of industrial society and force America to live in localized agrarian communities. Kevin Phillips, your new book, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism, it seems to me that in many ways this lamentable experience we've gone through for the last 7 years is sort of bookended by Ken Lay, in the sense that the secret energy task force meetings that Dick Cheney fought to keep secret, took it all the way to the Supreme Court. We still don't know what went on in those meetings, but we know that the minute that the Bush regime came into power, the first thing that happened was they stole $30 billion from the state of California, not them directly, but Enron did. And then when I hear about what just happened recently with subprime, you learn that, in fact, the same MO was used. They sat on the FERC to allow the theft to take place. And in the case of the predatory lending, apparently all 50 states' attorney generals tried to do something about it, but the Fed stepped in and forbid them from doing anything about investigating predatory lending. And they used some obscure 1842 Bank Act or something. So what do you think of my lamentable theory that the ghost of Ken Lay is still rattling around in that White House?
Well, I guess I wouldn't go quite so far, but certainly the Bush administration is amenable and very friendly with, and too friendly with, large portions of the economic power structure. But in terms of what they were up to in 2001 when Dick Cheney had a secret task force, best of my understanding, what they didn't want to come out, in addition probably to close relationships with the oil people, I think it was because they were looking at a whole series of maps in the Persian Gulf area, but particularly in Iraq, as to where the oil deposits were. And that would comport with the argument that almost from the beginning, the Bush administration was interested in solving the oil problem by invading Iraq. And I tend to buy that. I think Cheney would have been focused on oil, and George W. Bush was focused partly on oil, but I think he also had this larger biblical end-time sense of Armageddon in the Middle East and so forth, and his chance to play this enormous role. You never know with George W., but
You mean the role of the Antichrist?
Well, no. Some people think that they put him in for that, too, but I think he had a different type of deification in mind. You have to remember, George W. started national politics as his father's liaison man with a religious right in 1988, and he was in charge of dealing with all kinds of people that he then became very, very close to. And I think part of what happened to him in his born-again experience was that he came to think he was born the second time for a purpose, and that purpose was pretty Middle Eastern. And there are some things that he said at different meetings that have been reported, not on our own television, but on the BBC, for example, about God told him to strike Afghanistan, God told him to strike Iraq, and God was telling him to make peace. So I think part of the motivation for the government going into Iraq was biblical in a sense. But for Cheney, I'm sure it was always about oil. And I think that's part of what that task force was up to.
But it's turned out to be very expensive oil, and we've got precious little of it. I mean, if you factor in the war, which is $3 trillion, that is a hidden cost, surely, in our energy budget.
I would figure in a lot more than that, but not for the same reason that Stiglitz does. If you go back and you look at the history of oil prices and what oil futures were going for in the futures market, and then you combine that analysis with what Cheney was up to in the task force, and I think they thought they could solve the oil problem by taking Iraq. And if they took Iraq, they could then open up the oil spigots, and they would be able to flood the market with more oil because Iraq had a lot of unused capacity and it hadn't been taken out of it for a long time. And that, of course, didn't work. The whole idea of invading Iraq and occupying it and starting up the oil machinery was totally flawed.
Well, recently, Kevin Phillips said Dick Cheney went over there apparently to lean on the Saudis to get them to glut the market a little in the lead up to this election to help John McCain. They've done that at least in the last two cycles. And apparently the Saudis said no this time. Whether they're currying favor with the Democrats, I don't know, but there's also a theory that they've reached peak.
Well, not only do some people think they've reached peak, they reached peak toleration of us in 2002. Because if you go back and you look at what happened, this is before the invasion of Iraq. Saudi Arabia cut back on the oil they would ship to the United States, and they started shipping more to China at that point. And it was a definite sign of dissatisfaction with the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the U.S. idea that if they could pump oil out of Iraq, they could bust OPEC. Saudis didn't like that one bit. So since that point, what you've seen is that the OPEC countries have been selling dollars out of their central bank reserves. They don't have nearly as many as they used to. And they now are even making noise about possibly they might change that you have to buy oil in dollars, which is what you have to do now. For example, former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker thinks that'll be changed pretty soon. And what we've seen with two oil men in the White House, President and Vice President, first time in American history, the price of oil went up 500% in the last 5 years. Now, that's not a favor to the local oil companies in the United States particularly, because the rise of these state-owned oil companies around the world means they can't expand. It's a miscalculation from their standpoint, too. But the point is that if this is a result when you have two oilmen in the White House, we'd have been better off with, a pair of good humor men or something. The notion of George Bush having an innate capacity for anything escapes me.
Well, it's true. It's a catalog of disasters, and, that's why I'm skeptical of conspiracy theories, because I think this is where the main fingerprints are, it appears. But
oh, yes.
One of the great ironies here is that the sovereign funds that are now getting incredibly rich, the Russians, the Venezuelans, the Saudis, the Emirates, etc., they're actually gaming the oil market to drive the price up. So it's a win-win for them. I mean, we are on the wrong end of everything.
Well, they're gaming the oil markets, but so are speculators. The big
that's
thing,
true. That's,
big thing, in my opinion, that's in there in the oil market that doesn't get discussed much in the so-called mainstream media. It's the peak oil theory that production of oil in the world will peak sometime in the next 12 to 15 years, and in many places it's peaked already. And if that's the case, then that's another factor underlying the rising price of oil. And of course, the whole centerpiece, until very recently, of the Federal Reserve policy of bringing down interest rates was that there was no inflation. And, guess what turned out to be very much in motion. So you can not only put Bush on the list of people that don't know what they're doing, you can put Ben Bernanke pretty high on that list, too.
Kevin Phillips, again, the author of Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. turning to American capitalism, and you're right to correct me. In fact, Goldman Sachs are the biggest gamers of the oil commodities market, I believe, short of Saudi Arabia and Russia. But it seems to me that's underlying this subprime collapse is really a crisis in American capitalism. We don't produce anything anymore. We just play with money. The analogy that was used by Michael Greenberger, who was on the chair of the Commodity Exchange Commission, was that it's rather like owning a team, and instead of investing in the team to make it better, all we do is sit at computer consoles and bet on the team whether it wins or loses.
Well, there's some truth to that. I would go for a more systemic analysis. Basically, what's happened in this country in the last 25 years is that whereas we used to be a manufacturing nation, and back in the 70s, 25 to 27% of GDP came out of manufacturing, only 10 to 12% out of finance. Now it's 20 to 21% out of finance and 12% out of manufacturing. Finance has risen on the back of a huge change in the United States from a making things culture into a debt and credit culture. And part of that is because as people haven't been able to keep up in terms of purchasing power, they've been borrowing. And part of what happened in the, from 2002 to 2006 was that they borrowed against houses. But we are at a point now where finance is so overextended, debt is so large. The amount of credit market debt in the United States between 1987 and 2007 quadrupled. And it's not government, it's private, coming out of the financial sector. So that when finance trembles and when finance misbehaves, it's not a peripheral sector, it's right at the heart of the economy. They talk about the real economy. That's a joke. Finance is the real economy. That's where you make the money. That's where the power is.
So how's it going to shake out? Because we don't have a social safety net. We don't have the kind of contract that the other European countries have with their citizens in terms of health care, vacations, childcare, or pregnancy leave, all of those things that we decry the Canadians and the Europeans about. It seems to me that in the absence of a social contract, what we've always relied upon, the working people in this country, the middle class, is cheap gasoline and cheap food. And it seems to me that those two things are blowing up in our face. So how much blood can you squeeze out of this turnip, particularly if people are losing the value in their home and they're maxed out on their credit cards?
Well, one of the questions, how much blood can you squeeze out of the turnip? How much coverage in the media and how much debate by politicians are you going to have out of the blood, of the blood in the turnip, and how many people are going to define what's happening? And one of the interesting nuances to me, my whole background is Republican, and I have no use for George W. Bush, but he would not be president if you had a strong Democratic Party. I mean, nobody like George W. should be in the White House, but, when he ran 4 years ago, I remember that he won, and there wasn't any question of counting that time, I don't think. So there's this sense that's quite correct in Washington that finance is not only a huge part of the economy, it's an even bigger part of the crowd that finance elections. And that if you want to raise money and you're a politician, the best people you can get to fundraise for you are the people wired into the financial networks around the country. And I can't imagine at this point that if the crisis doesn't go past where it is now, and I think it will, but if it doesn't, that the Democrats are going to rise up and tell their benefactors. And Hillary and Barack Obama have gotten more money from finance than McCain has. It's difficult for me to see what's going to happen to force people to really seriously discuss what's happening.
Well, but is there an explanation of that in as much as George W. Bush, and particularly Dick Cheney, don't necessarily do the bidding of the traditional financial establishment? They seem to be more out of the sort of Texas mafia, and Tom DeLay was he was the enabler of all the bottom feeders in the economy, and Enron, of course, is being the model of the ultimate bottom feeder. So my sense is that maybe there's the reason that they're supporting Obama and Hillary is that they realize these guys have been bad for everybody.
Well, I don't want to disillusion you too much, but let me start with former Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, who worked for Clinton, was one of the ones who actually called up the Treasury during the Bush administration and sort of urged a bailout of Enron, because Enron was a big client of Citigroup, the bank where he was chairman of the management committee. And as a matter of fact, just the other day, no more than a month ago, Citi settled with the government over their collusion with Enron in all kinds of games and paid $1.5 billion in a fine. Now, I'm all for cracking down on all the Enron crowd, but frankly, I'd put Citigroup right in there with them. If they've got, they shouldn't keep their bank license.
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, the tragedy is that that there's a really good reporter for the Fortune magazine, Kimberly McLean, who was breaking the story about how Enron was a house of cards. And this was at the time when they were meeting in the Energy Task Force. And then as soon as they got into power, the Bush administration, their guy at the FERC, who was a protege of Ken Lay's, sat on the FERC while they raided California, stole $30 billion, and that kept Enron going longer. So in the end of the day, of course, they were able to loot the pensions and destroy so much value.
Well, that's absolutely right. The extent to which Enron people from Texas arrived with the Bush administration was staggering, the number of jobs they had. Karl Rove had used Enron as a kind of a checking account for getting money to friends of the administration,
right.
friends of George W. Bush.
They paid for the recount in Florida, too.
Well, maybe partly. The trouble with all of this is, in the last 20 years, whenever any part of business and finance has had money to slosh around Washington, they had two pockets to put it in, and the Democrats were just about as willing to take it as the Republicans, especially Bill Clinton, who, one of his last things in power was to pardon Mark Rich, who was a billionaire commodity speculator. I'll do the biggest number on George W. I can. I wrote a book about how lousy his dynasty was. But the notion that this is a one-party failure, this is a two-party failure, and that's why in the course of the last 20 years, the total credit market debt in the United States has gone from $11 trillion to $50 trillion. And this has gone to a lot of different places, and it hangs over the economy like a leaning tower of Pisa. And the reason you will never hear these statistics is the pot can't call the kettle black.
Well, you have to add to that, too, the below the iceberg is this all of the debt, the CDOs. Nobody really knows the extent of it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's pure gimmickry. And the reason why they had to dip so low in the types of mortgages they wrote was that basically you had pretty high home ownership in the United States. So you'd gotten the most of the plausible customers for mortgages. And there was this huge demand from the banks and the broker-dealers because they needed mortgages for what they called securitization. They'd take 500 or 1,000 or 1,500 and they put them together and they make a mortgage-backed security out of it or a collateralized debt obligation. And this stuff is all over the place and some of it's worthless now. But the point was they got paid as soon as they repackaged it in that form. And then they sold it to the second state bank of Schleswig-Holstein or something, where they had no idea what it was worth, and it had a AAA rating from other people who were part of the sort of footsie game. And buckets of money were made out of it. People have seen that in the last year, six or eight hedge fund people made over $1 billion in a year. You can't make that in anything else. There's nobody in the oil business who's running a company who's making that money out of oil. This is finance, and it's got its tendrils around both parties.
Well, indeed, and of course, on the other side, you know, the people who George Bush referred to as his ownership society, those people who got into homes with these subprimes, they're all being evicted, and it just gets you back to what you're talking about, that this is a collective disaster here, both the Republicans and the Democrats. But so if you accept the premise that the people in Washington represent capital, they don't represent us. Where is the revolution going to take place, and how's it going to... I mean, there's an indication that maybe Obama, when he says, I don't owe this town anything, you know, the fact that I haven't been in here long enough is a virtue. Is he a possible standard bearer, or do you think it's impossible to clean up Dodge?
Well, I think he's a possible standard bearer, but I think it's going to be very difficult to clean up Dodge unless somehow you win a clear, solid election after a bold campaign in which you identify all the things that need to be talked about, talk about them, and get a mandate. We had an outsider president who said he didn't know Washington anything. His name was Jimmy Carter. He came to Washington, and they figured what they owed him was a little bit of a fleecing and sending him home without much credibility, and they basically did exactly that. I'm not convinced at this point that Obama can win with enough of a mandate to do anything other than arrive there and have trouble governing, because the crisis is so bad by that point that you're really going to have to take extreme measures, and he won't have laid the groundwork. But, you know, that's my pessimism, and it's based on many, many years of watching all of this. That's why I can make a good argument for Hillary and Obama getting together and negotiating some kind of package deal in which they sort of re-sculpt the government and some of the relations between president and vice president in the name of a crisis. And if they do that, then maybe they can win the election together, and maybe they can get a mandate.
Well, Kevin Phillips, thank you so much for joining us, and for bad money, bad government, bad everything.
Bad money, bad dog. That's the point.
Again, I thank you for joining
us.
And I was just speaking then with Kevin Phillips, author and commentator, and he was responsible for the Republican Southern strategy that's allowed that party to hold on to the executive branch for the last 4 decades, and his new book again, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Stay tuned. This Background Briefing. I'm Ian Bastos. We're at the Los Angeles Times Book Fair, and we have a number of authors to join us. Raj Patel is coming up. Then, now I'm joined by Raj Patel, who's a scholar, journalist, activist, and author. His new book is Stuffed and Starved, which is about why the world experiences both obesity and hunger on a broad scale. Raj Patel has worked at the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and the United Nations. He has since become an outspoken and noted critic of all of these organizations. More recently, has lived and worked extensively in Zimbabwe and South Africa. He was refused a visa extension by the Mugabe regime for his political involvement with the pro-democracy movement. And he's written a number of influential criticisms on various aspects of politics and research methods of the World Bank. And his website is www.stuffedorstarved.org. And you're obviously, reading the New York Times today, I was reading about the reporter, the New York Times reporter who got arrested by Zimbabwe's goons. So you're probably better off here in sunny California than taking on that regime.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was lucky. I was merely denied a visa. But for, you know, for the people I was working with, things were much, much harder. And many have been injured, and a few have been killed since I left there in 2002.
Mm. So in terms of your book, do you think that just as we've had an oil shock, are we going to have a food shock?
We're in the middle of a food shock right now, and I think that this is something that is very underreported in America. I mean, right now you're hearing stories of middle class American families that are skipping meals, where the mothers are skipping meals so that their kids can afford to eat. Families are giving up on red meat, not because they've got vegetarian religion, but because it's so expensive. And if it's happening in the States, it's certainly happening in the developing world. I mean, Haiti had food riots a couple of weeks back, where, as a consequence of those riots, the prime imposed. So you're certainly seeing similar processes with the oil shock, the credit crunch, and the food crisis. That they're all tied together.
Well, it does seem that the culprit here, surely, when you have both obesity and hunger in this country, and I think something like 60% of the population are seriously overweight. It seems to me that it's obviously diet, and is it, simply put, corporate food?
Yes, it is, and I think that this is something that's hard, particularly in the States, to get your head around, because so much of the way we consume and the food we eat, we are told, is convenient. And, well, yes, it is convenient if you're working harder than any other industrialized nation on earth to take things like health, you know, to be able to ensure that you have access to healthcare. And if you're working very far from where you live, then you're going to be commuting a very long time. And if you're if you're in a working community, you have less access to fresh fruits and vegetables and more access to corporate food. And you have less access to green space. And so altogether, there's this constellation of reasons why working Americans are exposed and are forced in many ways to choose food that is corporate and that is unhealthy. And this is a story then not only about the corporate food, but a bigger story about the pace of American life and the structure of American life.
Well, the one thing, if you go through your pantry and you look at the labels on all the corporate food, the biggest ingredient, the number one ingredient, which they put that first, is usually corn syrup.
That's right. You'll find corn syrup in just a lot of food, but an ingredient that you'll find more, and that most Americans eat every day without knowing it, is soy. Soy is in three quarters of everything that's processed on the supermarket shelves, and in almost everything that the fast food industry produces. And it's used. I mean, we eat it either as a food additive, or as a lot of the soy that we eat is first is fed to animals. Because humans are very bad at digesting soy. The only thing you get from eating soy, if you're human, is flatulence. But if you feed it to animals, the animals grow very quickly. So chicken really is just soy with feathers. Soy is in almost everything, and it is, a perfect example of how the modern industrial process of producing food can turn a fantastic ingredient like soy into something that's almost a tyranny. And the real tyranny, I think, is in the soy plantations in Brazil, where there are recorded instances of slavery, and where the soy plantations encroach on the Amazon and on the rainforest. And there's a great deal of environmental destruction and social harm that comes from soy, none of which we ever taste.
So I'm trying to get my head around this. I thought soy was good, like tofu is what healthy people eat, right? But you're saying that in corporate food it's actually a filler, is it?
Well, it's a bit of everything. I mean, soy appears in everything from vegetable oil to the ink in our newspapers is soy based. And Henry Ford, and I think it's very telling that it was Henry Ford who did this. Henry Ford was so enamored of soy that he wanted to grow entire cars out of soy in his Dearborn, Michigan plant. In fact, by the end of the 1930s, 2 bushels of soy were in every Ford motor car, either as fiber or as paint or as lacquer, a range of things. So soy gets to be appears in all our food because it is so flexible that through the techniques of industrial chemistry, it can be transformed into something that's utterly unrecognizable as food.
Hmm. Well, Raj Patel, let's talk more about the food shock, because it seems to me that when we talked about the oil shock and a food shock, but there's obviously a connection here, because we're diverting a lot of corn in this country into ethanol production, from all analysts saying that it's absolutely a boondoggle. It's an outrageous boondoggle. Just, in fact, it may be a perfect example of who controls our government, and the extent to which big lobbyists like Cargill and ADM, obviously through the farm belt and through all those senators, because there's 2 senators for every little state, they're able to push this stuff through. So when are we going to have a real manifestation of the cost of filling up your tank with ethanol vis-a-vis seeing starving people around the world?
Well, I think we're seeing that already as well. Certainly biofuels are an insane idea. They're being sold to us as a way of fighting climate change, but it takes more CO2 to produce biofuels than you do by actually burning them. And this is why the European Union is sort of backing away from this biofuels idea. But the United States is very gung-ho about it for precisely the reasons you say. It's an election year, and all 3 presidential candidates have been pledged themselves to biofuel.
Iowa being the first state they campaign in.
Exactly. It's insane. I mean, really, the only reason that biofuel is popular here is, at the end, a very jingoistic idea that it is better to burn American corn than it is to burn Saudi oil. And it's, I mean, it's a preposterous idea. It has nothing to do with energy independence. I mean, if we wanted to do energy independence properly, we'd raise gas standards on cars. But that's not the sort of energy independence that that gets talked about. So you're right. I mean, the ethanol explosion here has everything to do with the lobbying power of Cargill and what have you. But we're seeing the consequences of that very directly, because the price of when you make ethanol, you use yellow corn, you use the corn that's produced in the Midwest, and it gets taken out of the food system and taken out of the food supply, and gets turned into ethanol, which shrinks the amount of yellow corn that's available for food, and that means that white corn, which is grown in Mexico, can substitute for this yellow corn to some extent. And the price of white corn was then bid up in a sort of a speculative bubble that then made it impossible for people in Mexico to be able to get the white corn to make tortillas. And so last year, we saw tortilla riots in Mexico City. And that was in no small part because of this insane idea here that the right thing to do with corn is not to eat it, but to set it on fire.
Mm. Well, we know that NAFTA has been a catastrophe for Mexican the rural sector in Mexico, and there's a sort of sardonic joke in Mexico that the last president, Vicente Fox, promised Mexicans 10 million new jobs. The only problem was they all ended up in the United States. So this is what's happened. They had to export their rural sector because of the devastation of NAFTA and the agricultural might of the United States. So here we have, we're turning our corn into a boondoggle. Mm-hmm. At the same time, climate change seems to be affecting much of the world's production. For example, there was an interesting series of articles in the New York Times about a big rice production operation in Australia that's because of climate change is no longer operating. Mm-hmm. And it made about 20%, produced about 20% of the world's rice.
Yeah, people who study climate change, they wince when someone says this is the first climate change-related famine, because you can't attribute any specific weather event to climate change. You can't say that the failure of harvest in Australia was because of climate change. But what is certainly the case is that weather is becoming far less predictable. And not on top of the climate change, we've got an outbreak of a certain kind of disease that affects wheat that's cutting into the grain basket in Central Asia. And all of these things are happening at the same time. But the thing that annoys me the most is that this in some way is being seen as unusual and unpredictable and cataclysmic. But all of human history is about managing the transition between seven fat years and the seven lean years. We always have cycles and fluctuations in the amount of harvest that we get. And all of human civilization has been about creating these grain stores, creating buffers in various ways so that communities can have some sort of insurance, some sort of protection against the vagaries of the weather, the market, whatever it is. But over the last 30 years, those lessons of all of human civilization have been cast away. And they've been cast away by organizations like the World Bank, by US foreign policy, by the World Trade Organization. And under that regime, countries are now not allowed to have grain stores. They're not allowed to support their local agriculture. They're not allowed to have taxes in order to be able to make domestic agriculture competitive with the vastly subsidized agriculture that we have in the United States or in Europe.
I mean, agribusiness agriculture.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's absolutely the case that the subsidies in the United States and Europe go to these agricultural giants, not to small family farms. I mean, small family farmers in Europe and North America are really up against the wall. They're in some very tough times indeed, at the same time as the US government is showering billions of dollars a year on agricultural industry as a whole, and most of it to industrial agriculture.
So, Raj Patel, what would you suggest? Not that anybody's listening to you or me in this, in the real world, but let's assume that they are. What would you suggest? I mean, you think that the entire world should decentralize, go away from the agribusiness model, back to family farms, and in the third world, back to what?
Hmm. I'm the lead and the ideas that I have here come from a group called Via Campesina. By some estimates, they have 150 million members. These are farmers from all around the world. And what they're suggesting is not some return to a bucolic past. They don't want to turn the clock back. They want a future where we actually have a democratic conversation about food, and we democratically decide how food is distributed and how it's grown. Because at the moment, the way food is distributed and grown is through the market. The trouble with that is that if you don't have enough money, you don't get to eat. That's the way the market distributes things, and we have allowed that kind of distribution to reign free, which is why we now face a world where, I mean, in a good year, 850 million people go hungry, and in 2008, it's almost certain that a billion people will go hungry, because they are too poor to be able to afford food. So what farmers around the world are suggesting is, well, hey, how about we, I mean, firstly, we need to have the sort of democracy, we need to have a proper exchange about how we do grow our food. But we also need things like land reform. We need women's rights. We need a series of things that aren't about turning the clock back. And if they were turning the clock back, women's rights would be out of the window. But in fact, what they're arguing for is more rights and more protections and more investment in sustainable agricultural technology and more investment in the way more investment in sustainable food systems. And that, you know, that is going to happen only through a democracy. And they've been saying this for years and years and years. And I'm hoping now, I mean, even though it's taken a crisis for it to happen, the governments will start listening to them. Certainly not to me, but to them.
And what about a revolution in terms of the consumer? Because if the consumers start boycotting corporate food because it's making them obese and destroying the health of their children. I mean, I don't know whether everybody should start growing a victory garden, but there has to be an alternative to what we have, because, you know, we're essentially dependent upon on corporate food, which is, as we started out, you know, with the ingredients, most of it's poisonous.
Right, no, exactly. And I think, I mean, certainly the first step is not to step into supermarkets. I mean, supermarkets are these sort of intensely manipulated environments where everything from the smell to the sounds to the lighting, everything, the position of everything in the supermarket is the result of millions of dollars of research and investment in how to make us consume more. And you know, the supermarket is then a very ironic place where we think that we're choosing freely, but in fact, most of the choices are being created for us by our environment.
So plus, of course, we have been propagandized into buying this stuff through the vast advertising budgets. Absolutely. I mean, there was a study done years ago that there's about in a tube of toothpaste, it's about 60% promotion and 1% cost. And that somebody did a study that the ingredients in Kellogg's Corn Flakes, actually the cardboard box was more nutritious than the. But you know, I can't swear that was a scientific study. But anyway.
But I mean, that's certainly true. That in general, we are up against some fairly tough odds. When, for example, we realise that for every dollar spent promoting food that is healthy, that is not corporate, $500 is spent promoting junk food. And this is why the McDonald's Golden Arches are now more widely recognised than the Christian Cross, because there is just this huge incentive, this huge amount of advertising in our culture. And if you think that doesn't influence you, then there's a very shocking figure that I talk about in Stuffed and Starved about Fiji. In Fiji, American terrestrial television wasn't accessible until 1995. By 1997, the rates of bulimia for Fijian teenage girls went from 0 to 12% in 2 years. And the only change that happened was these body images on television were now encouraging girls to become absolutely transform themselves. So culture has everything to do with it. And I think the solution has to be to change our culture, to step out of the supermarket and get connected to local markets, local farmers' markets, for example, particularly the ones where people don't speak English. Those tend to be cheap. And they tend to be ones where you can get local and really exciting ingredients.
Well, because we had a wonderful example of that in the South Central Farms, which ended up in tragedy with this horrible landlord just out of spite destroying the whole thing. So for every revolution, there's a counter-revolution, I guess.
Well, I mean, this is why it's a battle. And you know, there are losses. And the South Central Farm was such an inspiration to people around the world. It wasn't just a Los Angeles thing. And you know, there's still every reason to sort of draw inspiration from that and try to make it happen in other places. So, for example, in San Francisco, inspired by the South Central Farmers, we are going to be digging up the garden outside City Hall and planting a victory garden. Now, to some extent, it's a stunt. Obviously, it's a stunt. You know, you're not going to feed San Francisco from the land outside City Hall, doesn't you know? But on the other hand, it's an organizing tool. It's a way of bringing communities together, and the seeds that you know that a fantastic immigrant-rich city like San Francisco can have. You have so many different things going on, so many weird plants that you've never heard of that taste fantastic. And having them grown side by side is a way of encouraging people to think about how we might transform our cities, how we might make our cities places where food is and is available. Fresh fruits and vegetables are accessible to working people. And you know, the place that does this best, weirdly, is Havana, where 70% of the food that is eaten in Havana comes from Havana. Now, I mean, it is possible to transform our cities into a place where we can grow our own food, where we are more connected, where our kids don't think that you know potatoes come from the supermarket, and you know that oranges come from the ground, and you know, absurd things that you know you certainly hear kids talking about these things because they have no idea. And we need to
It's interesting that Cuba, of course, was the country that experienced the oil shock worse than anybody, because when they lost the Soviet subsidies, suddenly there was no oil, and they adapted. So you're suggesting that they were also ahead of the curve in terms of the kind of food that you're talking about that we need, as opposed to corporate food.
Well, yeah.
Human
food. Yeah, I mean, Cuba adopted a whole bunch of things under duress, as you say, because of the being cut off from Soviet subsidies, from and also from tractors and from fertilizer. Cuba was the second largest importer of agricultural fertilizer and pesticides in all of the Americas until the fall of the Soviet Union, and they had to shift. From a kind of agriculture that was very fossil fuel intensive to one that really didn't have any. They went through two very dark years, but then the Cuban people, not the Cuban government, demanded firstly land reform so that people had land to give to their kids, which always increases agricultural productivity. But then they also demanded that Cuban scientists come to the fields and develop new kinds of agricultural technology, agroecological technologies that aren't about fertilizers and pesticides, but are about growing an ecosystem that is in harmony with nature. And actually, they were very ahead of the curve, as you say, because recently there's been an international panel of agricultural experts that, you know, from the private sector, from the public sector, from international organizations, and they found that not only is organic food, you know, there is enough, it is possible to feed the world using organic and agroecological technologies. We won't be able to feed the world if we use any other way. It has to be this. It has to be organic. It has to be sustainable.
Well, Raj Patel, there's nothing more, a greater contrast to that is what's happening with Monsanto. They're getting all the farmers hooked on their genetically engineered seeds. Mm. And I just saw a piece on ABC News the other night where they actually have the ability to go on people's farms to find out whether they're bootlegging or not paying for these. And they can go through and rip out your crops and bankrupt you. So there's a kind of tyranny now coming on from these big agribusiness companies.
Oh, yeah. No. One of my informants for this book told me a nasty story about it. I mean, this was an idea that hasn't yet made it out into the world, but it was being experimented in Monsanto's labs, which is they were trying to genetically modify the leaves of Monsanto trademarked plants so that they could use a satellite to see whether you were growing their crops or not. That you know, the leaves would refract light in a particular way, and that they could observe from space whether you were violating their intellectual property rights or not. Now that's the worst. I mean, that's a horrifying big brother in agriculture kind of future. That's just one example of how a lot of Monsanto's engineering and a lot of its behavior is not about you know creating more food, but about protecting profits. The proof of the pudding here is tragically, I mean, in India, for example, genetically modified cotton is much more expensive. So farmers borrow a lot of money to be able to buy it. And when the harvest fails, they despair. They despair at losing land that has been in their families for generations. And so you see an epidemic of farmer suicides very closely associated with genetically modified crops.
Mm. Does anybody here want to ask Raj a question? Rather than phone in, you can actually be there in person. Okay. Well, let me turn then to your immediate experience where you spent a lot of time in Zimbabwe and South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing some stories on what's happening there as much as you can. You know, it's closed off to the press. I did a story last week with the fellow that broke the story about the Chinese ship with the arms called Noseweek. I don't know if you know.
Yeah,
Martin Wells. And he was suggesting that there's some positive stuff happening in terms of civil society in South Africa, and Mbeke's, you know, way behind the curve. But it is an intractable and tragic situation. It comes down to basically the psychosis of this one man, it appears.
It is, but actually, one needs to ask, why is it that Mugabe can stay in power? And certainly outside Zimbabwe, in a number of African countries, he's a folk hero. And he's a folk hero because he took back land that had been appropriated by whites and redistributed it. Now, that's the only story that most people get to hear, that there was someone who had the spine to do some redistribution. And a lot of Africa is crying out for redistribution, which is why Mugabe can be transformed into this guy who's doing good for the common man. But of course, you're right. I mean, Mugabe is in many ways an absolute tyrant. And he's also a very wily politician. And he has been for over 20 years. I mean, from the moment he got into power in 1980, he's waged war on, within Zimbabwe. There's a civil war in which, by some estimates, 30,000 people died. But then he consolidated power, and he's been sort of going on strong for a very long time. And I think part of that ability to go strong feeds on this ability of being able to paint himself as a redistributor. And particularly, I mean, if you compare Zimbabwe to South Africa, we imagine, is the land where things have gone right. Apartheid is over and everything's fine. But since the end of apartheid, less than 5% of the land in South Africa has been redistributed from whites to blacks. And there's a lot of resentment about that. If you talk to farmers across the world, they all want land reform. And that's why Mugabe can become this kind of folk hero, even though he's a jackbooted thug, because he's able to play the redistribution card when no other government has the spine to talk about redistribution.
Well, because he's given a lot of that land to his cronies.
Of course.
And he and his cronies are all in the smuggling business from mm-hmm. diamonds and minerals out of the Central Africa. So it's really a kleptocracy. But what happened to the agriculture, though? In terms of your whole thesis here, Raj Patel, how did the agriculture of Zimbabwe collapse so calamitously? And why, from a country that was exporting food now, there's signs of starvation?
Well, again, it's important to remember, even when Zimbabwe was doing tremendously well, I mean, Zimbabwe used to be the world's third largest exporter of tobacco, for example, and it was a very rich agricultural country. But at the same time, there were still people going hungry in Zimbabwe, and that's because, again, the way the people got some people were too poor to be able to afford that food. But certainly what you've seen since then is, because Zimbabwe has not invested in a kind of sustainable agriculture, in an agriculture that supports sustainable small-scale family farming, you've got these huge plantations that are now, that have been redistributed in, as you say, a kleptocracy. But there hasn't been the investment in support, in what's called agricultural extension services, in the kinds of things that farmers need in order to be able to get the most out of their land, technical expertise, irrigation, all these things have basically fallen apart. And that's why certainly Zimbabwean agriculture has faltered, because its government is not supporting it.
So back to the notion that we're both obese and hungry in this country. I'm wondering if at the end of the day, the real issues here are, how much is essentially overpopulation and the depletion of agricultural land? Because every year, I believe, a tremendous amount of agricultural land is lost. and it's true in China, there's a tremendous loss of land. So you can see a rather dystopian future here. If global warming eats up a lot of land, if it literally goes underwater, and you have the degradation of so much agricultural land that's just happening on a largely to do, I think, with corporate agriculture, because they don't diversify the crops. And as you were saying, in terms of, you know, smaller self-sustaining eco farms is it just that you know, that there's just too many of us to feed? I mean, do you see a way that you could actually fairly distribute food and grow sufficient for so that nobody on this planet would starve?
Well, I mean, we have enough food right now to be able to feed the world. The problem is that the way it's distributed is according to purchasing power. And so, for example, people who are able to eat meat are able to take grain away from people who can only afford to eat grain, and they price that grain out of the market. And so, I mean, I don't see a way that we can carry on eating the way that we do and expect there to be for everyone to be fed. I mean, there isn't enough land on the planet, no matter how you grow your food, for people to be able to eat like Americans do. There just isn't the planet to sustain our level of meat consumption, our level of calorie consumption.
But 60% are a bunch of tubs. Well, grotesquely. Who'd want to look like us?
But this is it. I mean, that's a very reasonable question. But the trouble is that because of the food marketing, for example, countries are going through this nutrition transition. They're moving from a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables to something that looks more like the American diet. And for me, the country that exemplifies this, the horrors of this the most, is India. India has let in the large agricultural corporations and the large food corporations since the 1990s. And since then, you can chart the rise of the incidence of type 2 diabetes, for example, so that today, India has the world's largest concentration of people with type 2 diabetes. Now that's, you know, that's the consequence of moving towards a diet that looks more like this one. But of course, as you say, this diet is killing us. It's not just that we're tubby. It's that we are living less, you know, and we're more prone to diseases. I mean, everything about the American diet is really toxic. And it's hurting us. And of course, because of the export of these food corporations, it's now starting to kill people in developing countries too.
Well, Raj Patel, you'd think we were broadcasting from the Vatican here with all these bells going off, but we're actually at the Los Angeles Times book fair at UCLA, and I thank you so much for joining us here, Raj Patel. Again, Raj Patel's a scholar, journalist, activist, and author. His new book is Stuffed and Starved, which is available everywhere.
Indeed, yeah.
And he is basically describing how we're experiencing both obesity and hunger on a broad scale. And Raj Patel's worked for the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the United Nations, and now he works against them, right?
Indeed.
You've been tear gassed on four continents.
That's right.
Anyway, thank you so much for
All
joining
right.
us.
Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure. And that's the audience here that have gathered at our booth here at UCLA. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, and Lick Duan, the assistant producer, and for this special live remote broadcast we're doing here today, Zubri Fields, the live remote engineer and operations director, G and Jose Juan Bustamante, the technical assistants, Melissa Figueroa, who's the board operator back at KPFK Studios in North Hollywood, and special thanks to Armando Cadinho and Jennifer Kaiser and Sue Welsh.